Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 883. The times, they have changed. JFK and the steel crisis of 1962. This is being recorded on December 31st of the year 2015. This is the transition from 2015 to 2016. And as we remember Auld Lang Syne, or commemorate Auld Lang Syne, and as we head into a presidential election year, I think it may prove educational to examine an aspect of JFK's presidency, his brief and violently attenuated presidency, by examining and relating a very profound incident or event in his presidency that has not received a great deal of attention. And I think that the behavior of President Kennedy with regard to the steel crisis of the spring of 1962 will reveal just how far we have come in the half century plus since JFK was killed. Indeed, I think the behavior of JFK toward the titans of Wall Street, so to speak, and big business is remarkable. Almost, I would say, almost incredible when compared with what is going on today. JFK wrote a popular book called Profiles in Courage. I think his successors, including Barack Obama, might very well, if they were going to write truthful autobiographies, their autobiographies should be called Profiles in Cowardice, because that sadly appears to be what they have basically, they have manifested in terms of their presidency. In the title of the program, there was a popular song, or a well-known song by Bob Dylan, The Times They Are a Changin', which served as something of an anthem for the progressive politics and for the aspirations of many people in the baby boomer generation, the civil rights movement, the free speech movement in Berkeley, and later the anti-Vietnam War movement, all to an extent drew on that sentiment, and in some cases actually the lyrics of that song, for inspiration and motivation. Well, the times, well, they may be changing, but they have changed. And I think by examining JFK's behavior vis-a-vis the steel crisis of 1962, I think we can see just how far down we have gone. I'm going to begin by reading the address that President Eisenhower gave shortly before he left office, in which he warned about the burgeoning military-industrial complex and what it had done for or to American society. Then, as the author of the book from which I'm going to be drawing, a very good book, a very important one, called JFK and the Unspeakable. It was authored by James W. Douglas, subtitled Why He Died and Why It Matters. It was published by Touchstone Books, the softcover edition, published in 2010. And it should be noted that the steel industry was a very important part of what Eisenhower termed the military-industrial complex. Obviously, many weapons, warships, cannons, armored vehicles do use steel, and beyond that, so many other manufactured products, buildings, automobiles, and others, various types of heavy equipment use steel. So Kennedy felt that it was important to avoid a significant rise in the price of steel in order to hold inflation down. He brokered an agreement with the United Steelworkers Union to hold down prices by settling for a very modest wage increase, far less than they had hoped for. And in turn, he received an agreement from U.S. Steel, the country's largest steel manufacturer, to hold down prices. However, shortly after that, he was surprised when the chairman of U.S. Steel, a guy named Roger Blough, last name B-L-O-U-G-H, confronted him or gave him a press release, which was also distributed simultaneously to various media voices, in which they announced a price increase. Kennedy was outraged, and he railed to his advisors, quoting his father, Joseph Kennedy Sr., who, by the way, had been FDR's head of the Securities and Exchange Commission and had clashed directly with the titans of Wall Street. JFK's father told him to, quote, "all businessmen are sons of bitches," unquote. And JFK related that to many of his advisors. He was outraged at the betrayal by Big Steel. It made the New York Times. JFK then responded by doing a number of things. He actually gave a national address in which he identified Big Steel as basically enemies of the public interest. He combined this by switching major defense contracts to smaller steel manufacturers who had not gone along with the price increase. After U.S. Steel increased their prices, Bethlehem Steel and four other of the largest domestic steel manufacturers raised their prices as well. So Kennedy began switching defense contracts to smaller manufacturers who had not raised their prices. This was combined with vigorous activity by the Justice Department, headed up by his brother, Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy began subpoenaing all of the corporate records and personal records, expense accounts, travel records of the various executives of the steel industry and the companies themselves. The FBI actually handled this, was carrying out these raids, in effect, the securing of the records. And Robert Kennedy also engaged and began launching antitrust investigations as well. There were a number of overlapping investigations. The IRS was brought in. And ultimately, Kennedy was able to jawbone the price increase back down. This earned him the undying enmity of big business in this country. Fortune magazine, which was published by Henry Luce, the publishing giant who also published Life magazine and Time magazine, and was very close himself to the intelligence community as well as to big business. There was an unsigned editorial in which the editorial blasted JFK in no uncertain terms, sort of compared him to a communist planned economy or economics or economists, and ultimately wound up through its title, issuing a very direct and blunt warning to JFK. The editorial was titled The Ides of April, in Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar is warned of his own impending assassination by a soothsayer who said, "Beware the Ides of March." And the editorial was titled The Ides of April. A very direct warning to JFK, and something that foreshadowed his assassination. When you compare what JFK did with regard to the steel industry and big business in general, I think we can see just how far we have come. Again, JFK published a very well-known book called Profiles in Courage. I think the contemporary political establishment who kowtow so shamelessly to big business at the expense, literally, of the general public and the general welfare, they might, if they were honest, publish political autobiographies titled collectively Profiles in Cowardice. So as we pass from one year into another, and as we inevitably look back and forward, and as we move into a presidential election year, I think contemplating JFK's behavior in the steel crisis is well worth doing. Reading from JFK and the Unspeakable by James W. Douglas, subtitled Why He Died and Why It Matters, we read, "The political context of Kennedy's assassination was described best by the president who preceded him. On January 17, 1961, 3 days before JFK was inaugurated as president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned of a new threat to freedom from within the U.S. In response to a threat from without, Eisenhower said, quote, "We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to the 3.5 million men and women who are directly engaged in the defense establishment, we annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved, so is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted." Eisenhower himself never used the power of his presidency to challenge this new threat to democracy. He simply identified it in a memorable way when he was about to leave office. He thereby passed on the possibility of resisting it to his successor. In Kennedy's short presidency, the military-industrial complex actually increased its profits and power. JFK's initial call to develop a military response to the Soviet Union and its allies that would be, quote, more flexible, unquote, than the Eisenhower policy of mutual assured destruction expanded the Pentagon's contracts with U.S. corporations. Yet in the summer of 1963, the leaders of the military-industrial complex could see storm clouds on the horizon. After JFK's American University address and his quick signing of the Test Ban Treaty with Khrushchev, corporate power holders saw war between the U.S. Corporate power holders saw the distinct prospect in the not-distant future of a settlement in the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Both Kennedy and Khrushchev were prepared to shift their war of conflicting ideologies to more peaceful fronts. Kennedy wanted a complete ban on the testing of nuclear weapons, then mutual steps in nuclear disarmament. He saw a willing partner in Khrushchev, who wanted to ease the huge burden of arms expenditures on the Soviet economy.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
In that direction of U.S.-Soviet disarmament lay the diminished power of a corporate military system that for years had controlled the U.S. government. In his turn toward peace, Kennedy was beginning to undermine the dominant power structure that Eisenhower had finally identified and warned against so strongly as he left the White House. In 1962, Kennedy had already profoundly alienated key elements of the military-industrial complex in the steel crisis. The conflict arose from JFK's preoccupation with steel prices, whose rise he believed, quote, quickly drove up the price of everything else, unquote. The president therefore brokered a contract signed on April 6, 1962, in which the United Steelworkers Union accepted a modest settlement from the United States Steel Company with the understanding that the company would help keep inflation down by not raising steel prices. Kennedy phoned identical statements of appreciation to union headquarters and the company managers, congratulating each for having reached an agreement that was, quote, obviously non-inflationary. When he finished the calls, he told advisor Ted Sorensen that the union members, quote, cheered and applauded their own sacrifice, unquote, whereas the company representatives were ice cold to him. It was a foretaste of the future. On April 10th, 1962, Roger Blau, B-L-O-U-G-H, chairman of U.S. Steel, asked to meet with Kennedy. At 5:45 p.m., seated next to JFK, Blau said, quote, perhaps the easiest way I can explain the purpose of my visit, and handed Kennedy four mimeographed pages. Blau knew the press release in the president's hands was being passed out simultaneously to the media by other U.S. Steel representatives. It stated that U.S. Steel, quote, effective at 12:01 a.m. tomorrow, will raise the price of the company's steel products by an average of about 3.5%. Kennedy read the statement, recognizing immediately that he and the steel workers had been double-crossed by U.S. Steel. He looked up at Roger Blau and said, quote, you have made a terrible mistake, unquote. After Blau departed, Kennedy shared the bad news with a group of his advisors. They had never seen him so angry. He said, quote, my father always told me that all businessmen were sons of bitches, but I never believed it until now. His explosive remark appeared in the New York Times on April 23rd, 1962. The corporate world never forgot it. He phoned Steelworkers Union President David McDonald and said, quote, Dave, you've been screwed and I've been screwed, unquote. The next morning, U.S. Steel was joined in its price increase by Bethlehem Steel, the second largest steel company in the country, and soon after by four others. In response, Kennedy mustered every resource he could to force the steel companies to roll back their prices. He began at the Defense Department. Defense contracts were critical to, quote, big steel, unquote, an industry that embodied the intertwined influence with the Pentagon that Eisenhower had warned against. Defense Secretary McNamara told the president that the combined impact in defense costs from the raise in steel prices would be $1 billion. Kennedy ordered him to start shifting steel prices at once to the smaller companies that had not yet joined in the raise. McNamara announced that a steel plate order previously divided between U.S. Steel and Lukens Steel, L-U-K-E-N-S, a tiny steel company that had not raised prices, would now go entirely to Lukens. Walter Heller, who chaired the President's Council of Economic Advisers, quote, calculated that the government used so much steel that it could shift as much as 9% of the industry's total business away from the six companies that had announced price rises to six that were still holding back. The president even ordered the Defense Department to take its steel business overseas, if that were necessary, to keep defense contracts away from U.S. Steel and its cohorts. Big steel executives saw that Kennedy meant business, their business, and that substantial Cold War profits were already being drained away from them. And next, take a look at what Robert Kennedy did. Can you imagine this taking place today? Attorney General Robert Kennedy moved quickly to convene a federal grand jury to investigate price fixing in Big Steel's corporate network. He looked into the steel company's possible violation of antitrust laws, an investigation his antitrust division had actually begun before the steel crisis. He now ordered the FBI to move on the steel executives with speed and thoroughness. As RFK said later in an interview, quote, we were going to go for broke, their expense accounts, and where they'd been, and what they were doing. I picked up all their records, and I told the FBI to interview them all, to march into their offices the next day. We weren't going to go slowly. I said to have them done all over the country. All of them were hit with meetings the next morning by FBI agents. All of them were subpoenaed for their personal records. All of them were subpoenaed for their company records. Steel executives suddenly found themselves being treated as if they were enemies of the people. The president then stated that they were precisely that. He opened his April 11th press conference by saying, quote, simultaneous and identical actions of U.S. Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable and irresponsible defiance of the public interest. The American people will find it hard, as I do, to accept a situation in which a tiny handful of steel executives whose pursuit of private power and profit exceeds their sense of public responsibility can show such utter contempt for the interests of 185 million Americans. Reporters gasped at the intensity of Kennedy's attack on Big Steel. After describing the ways in which steel executives had defied the public interest, JFK concluded with an ironic reference to his inaugural address. Quote, some time ago I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country, and I asked the steel companies as well. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer. On April 12th, Kennedy sent his lawyer Clark Clifford, C-L-I-F-F-O-R-D, to serve as a mediator with U.S. Steel. The steel executives, feeling the heat from the White House, proposed a compromise. Clifford phoned the president to say, Blau and his people want to know what you would say if they announce a partial rollback of the price increases, say 50%. I wouldn't say a damn thing, Kennedy replied. It's the whole way, unquote. Clifford was instructed to say that, quote, if U.S. Steel persisted, the president would use every tool available to turn the decision around, unquote. That included especially switching more defense contracts away from them to more affordable companies. There was to be no compromise. Clifford reported back to the Steelheads that, quote, the president was already setting in motion to use the full power of the presidency to divert contracts from U.S. Steel and the other companies, unquote. Adding the quote, he still had several actions in reserve, including tax audits, antitrust investigations, and a thorough probe of market practices, unquote. The president was prepared to wage a domestic war against Big Steel's price increase. On April 13th, 1962, Big Steel's executives surrendered. The first company to yield was Bethlehem Steel, another major defense contractor. The reason, reported back to the White House, was that, quote, Bethlehem had gotten wind that it was to be excluded from bidding on the construction of three naval vessels the following week and decided to take quick action, unquote. Bethlehem was followed soon by the giant U.S. Steel. The president's offensive, backed by overwhelming public support, had been too much for them. All six steel companies rescinded the entire price raise that their point man, Roger Blau, had conveyed to JFK as an accomplished fact 3 days before. As would be his attitude after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy, as Theodore Sorensen said, quote, permitted no gloating by any administration spokesman and no talk of retribution, unquote. He was especially gracious toward Roger Blau, whom he subsequently invited often to the White House for consultations. When asked by a reporter at a press conference about his, quote, rather harsh statement about businessmen, unquote, JFK revised his infamous SOB remark. He said that his father, a businessman himself, had met only, quote, the steel men, unquote, with whom he had been, again quoting, involved when he was a member of the Roosevelt administration in the 1937 strike. This explanation would not win the hearts of business leaders. As they knew well, JFK's father, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., or the businessman himself, had also been President Franklin D. Roosevelt's first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. As a former Wall Street insider who knew the system, the senior Kennedy had cracked down on Wall Street profiteers. Some of the financial titans of the 30s regarded JFK's father as a class traitor, the Judas of Wall Street, unquote, for his work on behalf of FDR. It was in the light of Joseph Kennedy's fight to initiate government controls over Wall Street and the opposition he encountered that he made his all businessmen are SOBs remark to JFK. That opinion of his father, President Kennedy told the press, quote, I found appropriate that evening when we had not been treated altogether with frankness. But that's past. That is past. Now we are working together, I hope. It was a vain hope. John and Robert Kennedy had become notorious in the ranks of big business. JFK's strategy of withdrawing defense contracts and RFK's aggressive investigating tactics toward men of power were seen as unforgivable sins by the corporate world. As a result of the president's uncompromising stand against the steel industry and implicitly any corporations that chose to defy his authority, a bitter gap opened up between Kennedy and big business, whose most powerful elements coincided with the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower had warned against. The depth of corporate hostility toward Kennedy after the steel crisis can be seen by an unsigned editorial in Fortune, media czar Henry Luce's magazine for the most fortunate. The editors of Fortune knew the decision to raise steel prices had been made by the Executive Committee of U.S. Steel's Board of Directors. It included top-level officers from other huge financial institutions, such as Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, the First National City Bank of New York, the Prudential Insurance Company, the Ford Foundation, and AT&T. When Roger Blau handed U.S. Steel's provocative press release to the president, he did so on behalf of not only U.S. Steel, but also those other financial giants in the U.S. The Fortune editorial therefore posed an intriguing question. Why did the financial interests behind U.S. Steel announce the price increase in such a way as to deliberately, quote, provoke the president of the U.S. into a vitriolic and demagogic assault, unquote. With the authority of an insider's knowledge that it denied having, Fortune answered its own question. There is a theory, unsupported by any direct evidence, that Blau was acting as a business statesman, unquote, rather than as a businessman judging his market, unquote. According to this theory, Kennedy's prior appeal to steel executives not to raise prices, leading to the contract settlement between the company and the union, had poised over the industry a threat of jawbone control of prices. For the sake of his company, the industry, and the nation, Blau saw the way to break the bland harmony that has recently prevailed between government and business. In plainer language, the president was acting too much like a president rather than just another office holder beholden to the powers that be. U.S. Steel, on behalf of still higher financial interests, therefore taunted Kennedy so as to present him with a dilemma. He either had to accept the price hike and lose credibility, or react as he did with power to roll back the increase and thereby unite the business world against him.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
His unswerving activist response then served to confirm the worst fears of corporate America, quote, that the threat of jawbone control, unquote, was no mere bugaboo, was borne out by the tone of President Kennedy's reaction and the threats of general business harassment by government that followed the affront. Thus, the steel crisis, in Fortune's view, threatened to propel an activist, anti-business president toward a fate like that of Julius Caesar. As Shakespeare had it, Caesar was warned of his coming assassination by a soothsayer. Beware the Ides of March, unquote. Fortune gave Kennedy a deadly warning of its own by the title of its editorial, Steel, the Ides of April. Robert Kennedy's Justice Department continued its antitrust investigation into the steel companies. U.S. Steel and seven other companies were eventually forced to pay maximum fines in 1965 for their price-fixing activities between 1955 and 1961. The steel crisis defined John and Robert Kennedy as Wall Street enemies. The president was seen as a state dictator. As the Wall Street Journal put it in the week after Big Steel surrendered to the Kennedys, quote, the government set the price, and it did this by the pressure of fear, by naked power, by threats, by agents of the state security police, unquote. U.S. News and World Report gave prominence in its April 30th, 1962 issue to an anti-Kennedy article on, quote, planned economy, unquote, that suggested that the president was acting like a Soviet commissar. Attorney General Robert Kennedy became a symbol of, quote, ruthless power, unquote, to the business titans he treated so brusquely, whose corporations he then found in violation of the law. Media controlled by the same interests adopted the characterization of RFK as ruthless until his own murder 6 years later. As John Kennedy became persona non grata to the economic elite of the U.S., his popularity increased elsewhere. He said on May 8, 1962, to a warmly welcoming convention of the United Auto Workers, quote, "Last week, after speaking to the Chamber of Commerce and the presidents of the American Medical Association, I began to wonder how I got elected. And now I remember. I said last week to the chamber that I thought I was the second choice for president of a majority of the chamber. Anyone else was first choice," unquote. John Kennedy, the son of a rich man who had fought Wall Street in the Roosevelt administration, was beginning to sound like a class heretic himself. He told the UAW, quote, "Harry Truman once said that there are 14 or 15 million Americans who have the resources to have representatives in Washington to protect their interests, and that the interests of the great mass of other people, the 150 or 60 million, is the responsibility of the President of the United States, and I propose to fulfill it," unquote. After the steel crisis, President Kennedy felt so much hostility from the leaders of big business that he finally gave up trying to curry their support. He told advisors Sorensen, O'Donnell, and Schlesinger, quote, "I understand better every day why Roosevelt, who started out such a mild fellow, ended up so ferociously anti-business. It is hard as hell to be friendly with people who keep trying to cut your legs off," unquote. If Fortune's editors were right in seeing a deliberate provocation of Kennedy, the instigators had succeeded in alienating the business elite from the president and vice versa. JFK joked about what his corporate enemies would do to him if they only had the chance. A year after the steel crisis, he learned before giving a speech in New York that elsewhere in the same hotel, quote, "the steel industry was presenting Dwight D. Eisenhower with its annual public service award," unquote. "I was their man of the year last year," said the president to his audience. "They wanted to come down to the White House to give me their award, but the Secret Service wouldn't let them do it," unquote. For the dark humor to work, Kennedy and his audience had to assume a Secret Service committed to shielding the president. However, as Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden had learned before he left the White House detail, the Secret Service agents around Kennedy were joking in a more sinister direction, that they would step out of the way if an assassin aimed a shot at the president. In Dallas, the Secret Service would step out of the way not just individually, but collectively. In his deepening alienation from the CIA, the Pentagon, and big business, John Kennedy was moving consciously beyond the point of no return. Kennedy knew well the complicity that existed among the Cold War's corporate elite, Pentagon planners, and the heads of intelligence agencies, unquote. He was no stranger to the way systemic power worked in and behind his national security state. But he still kept acting, quote, "for the interests of the great mass of other people," unquote, and, as his brother Robert put it, to prevent, quote, "the specter of the death of the children of this country and around the world," unquote, i.e. nuclear war. That put him more and more deeply in conflict with those who controlled the system. We have no evidence as to who in the military-industrial complex may have given the order to assassinate President Kennedy. That the order was carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency is obvious. The CIA's fingerprints are all over the crime and the events leading up to it. By the way, I would, parenthetically, I think that This is something of an oversimplification. Certainly the CIA was deeply involved. I don't think then CIA Director John McCone actually gave the order. It was certainly much more than just the CIA. There were elements of the military involved, and indeed elements of the Army Reserve Intelligence were actually present in Dealey Plaza during the assassination, and in AFA program number 37, how the U.S. lost the Second World War, we went into some of those connections in a couple of the major episodes of that series. Continuing with James W. Douglas's account, according to the Warren Report, Lee Harvey Oswald told the U.S. Embassy in Moscow on October 31st, 1959, that his new allegiance was to the USSR. He said he had promised Soviet officials he, quote, would make known to them all information concerning the Marine Corps and his specialty therein, radar operation, as he possessed, unquote. However, the Warren Report did not mention that in the Marine Corps, Oswald had been a radar operator specifically for the CIA's top-secret U-2 spy plane. By not admitting Oswald's U-2 or CIA connections, the Warren Commission avoided the implications of his offering to give, quote, something of special interest, unquote, to the Soviets. Oswald was either a blatant traitor or, as his further history reveals, a U.S. counterintelligence agent being dangled before the Russians as a Marine expatriate. The head of the CIA's counterintelligence branch from 1954 to 1974 was James Jesus Angleton, known as the poet spy. As an undergraduate at Yale in the early 40s, Angleton had founded a literary journal, Furioso, which published the poetry of Ezra Pound, E.E. Cummings, and Archibald MacLeish. After he went on to Harvard Law School, Angleton was drafted into the U.S. Army. He became a member of the counterintelligence branch of the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, World War II predecessor to the CIA. The OSS and CIA suited Angleton perfectly. Counterintelligence became less a wartime mission than a lifelong obsession. For Angleton, the Cold War was an anti-communist crusade, with his CIA double agents engaged in the battle of light against darkness. Investigative journalist Joseph Trento testified in the 1984 court deposition that, according to CIA sources, James Angleton was a supervisor of a CIA assassination unit in the 1950s. The small assassination team was headed by Army Colonel Boris Pash. At the end of World War II, Army Intelligence Colonel Pash had rounded up Nazi scientists who could contribute their research skills to the development of U.S. nuclear and chemical weapons. The CIA's E. Howard Hunt, while imprisoned for the Watergate break-in, told the New York Times that Pash's CIA assassination unit was designed especially for the killing of suspected double agents. That placed Pash's terminators under the authority of counterintelligence chief Angleton. Joseph Trento testified that his sources confirmed, quote, Pash's assassination unit was assigned to Angleton, unquote. In the 1960s, Angleton retained his authority over assassinations. In November of 1961, the CIA's Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Bissell, directed his longtime associate William Harvey to develop an assassination program. In November of 1961, the CIA's Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Bissell, directed his longtime associate William Harvey to develop an assassination program known as ZR Rifle and to apply it to Cuba, as the Senate's Church Committee had discovered. Among the notes for ZR Rifle that Harvey then scribbled to himself were, quote, planning should include provisions for blaming the Soviets or the Czechs in case of blow. should have Phony 201, a CIA file on any person, quote, of active operational interest, unquote, in RG Central Registry to backstop this. All documents therein forged and backdated, unquote. In other words, in order to blame an assassination on the communists, the patsy should be given Soviet or Czechoslovakian associations. Oswald's would be Soviet and Cuban. An appropriately fraudulent CIA 201 personnel file should be created for any future assassination scapegoat with, quote, all documents therein forged and updated. Harvey also reminded himself that the phony 201, quote, should look like a CE, counter-espionage file, and that he needed to talk with, quote, Jim A., a.k.a. James Angleton, head of CIA counterintelligence. William Harvey headed Staff D, a top-secret CIA department that was responsible for communications intercepts received from the NSA. Assassinations prepared by Harvey were therefore given the same ultimate degree of secrecy as the NSA's intercepts under the higher jurisdiction of James Angleton. Any access to Staff D could be granted only by, quote, Angleton's men, unquote, according to CIA agent Joseph B. Smith. As we shall see in the Oswald Project under Angleton's supervision, the CIA's counterintelligence head blended the powers of assassination and disinformation. Deception was Angleton's paradoxical way toward the victory of the light. In the war against communism, Angleton thrived on deceiving enemies and friends alike in the milieu he liked to call the wilderness of mirrors, unquote. His friend E.E. Cummings suggested the contradictions in James Angleton in a letter he wrote to Angleton's wife, quote, what a miracle of momentous complexity is the poet, unquote.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
In the mid-1970s, the Senate Church Committee on Intelligence and the House Select Committee on Assassinations opened the CIA's lid on Lee Harvey Oswald and discovered James Jesus Angleton. They found that Angleton's Special Investigations Group, or SIG, and CIA counterintelligence held a 201 file on Oswald in the 3 years prior to JFK's assassination. Considering what William Harvey wrote about creating phony 201 files for ZR/rifle scapegoats, an obvious first question is, how genuine is Oswald's file, or what little we have been given from it? And in any case, judging from the interview of a key witness about Oswald's file in Angleton's SIG office, its mere presence in that particular location was enough to give the game away. It was Angleton's staff member, Ann Egerter, E-G-E-R-T-E-R, who opened Oswald's 201 SIG file on December 9th, 1960. Egerter was questioned by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They knew they could not expect her, as a CIA employee, to answer truthfully, even under oath, the question whether Oswald was a CIA agent. Alan Dulles, Kennedy's fired CIA director, had said in the January 27, 1964, closed-door Warren Commission meeting that no CIA employee, even under oath, should ever truthfully say if Oswald or anyone else was in fact a CIA agent. The House Select Committee, therefore, had to get the answer from Angleton's associate, Ann Egerter, by then retired and somewhat obliging by indirect questioning. When Egerton was asked the purpose of counterintelligence's Special Investigation Group, or CI/SIG, she said, quote, we were charged with the investigation of agency personnel who were suspected one way or another, unquote. Eggertzer had thereby already made a crucial admission whose implications would be drawn out step by step. Her HSCA interviewer then asked Eggertzer to confirm this specific purpose of SIG. Quote, please correct me if I am wrong. In light of the example that you have given and the statements that you have made, it seems that the purpose of CI/SIG was very limited, and that limited purpose was being to investigate agency employees who for some reason were under suspicion. Eggertzer replied, that is correct. She was then asked, when the 201 file is opened, does that mean that whoever opens the file has either an intelligence interest in the individual or, if not an intelligence interest, he thinks that the individual may present a counterintelligence risk? Eggertzer, well, in general, I would say that would be correct. Interviewer, would there be any other reason for opening up a file? Eggertzer, no, I can't think of one. I'm skipping down. Her interviewer, in turn, patiently sought reconfirmation of this stated purpose of her office that so strongly implied Oswald was a CIA employee under investigation by the agency itself. Interviewer, I hope you understand my questions are directed toward trying to find out what the purpose of the CISIG office was and under what circumstances was the opening up of the 201 file on Oswald. I am given the impression that the purpose of CISIG was very limited, primarily to investigate agency employees who for one reason or another might be under suspicion of getting espionage against the United States. Is that an accurate statement of the purpose of CISIG? Eggertzer, well, it is employees and also penetration, which is the same thing of the agency. And Eggertzer's testimony points toward Oswald having been a CIA employee who by December of 1960 had come under suspicion by the agency. He was to be carefully watched. As a security risk, he was also the ideal kind of person for the CIA to offer up 3 years later as a scapegoat in the assassination of a president who some believed had become a much greater security risk. Well, obviously, we have been filling in some of the information about the not only a part of the CIA's counterintelligence assassination mechanism, but also some of the steps that were to be taken by William Harvey's ZR/rifle program to basically frame any suspects as of either Soviet or Czechoslovakian origin or derivation. And ultimately Oswald was given a combination of Soviet and Cuban, basically a legend was created to make Oswald look like a Soviet sympathizer and a Castro sympathizer as well. We've gone into this in many, many programs. The gigantic aforementioned AFA program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, goes into that at considerable length. The August 2nd and August 30th, 1992 installments of AFA 37 go into that at great length. We've gone into that in other programs as well. Most recently, for the record, 876 about the OUNB and the assassination of JFK. I've been providing a little bit of supplemental information to the actual discussion of JFK and the Steel Crisis of 1962, simply in order to sort of flesh out James W. Douglas's statements that the about the military-industrial complex, the powerful role that big business played in that, and the results that that ultimately bore for the political process. Again, I'm mentioning this as we are closing out 1 year and heading into another, 2016 being a presidential election year, by way of measuring just how far down we have gone. By the way, U.S. Steel was a company that was formed under the direction of J.P. Morgan, and the actual legal machinations of cobbling together a number of different steel companies was handled by the powerful Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, two of whose major partners were John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, although this took place well before the Dulles brothers became involved with Sullivan and Cromwell. It's worth noting that Alan Dulles was a key member of the Warren Commission, and most researchers feel that he was deeply involved in the assassination itself. A quality recent book called The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot goes into that. We've discussed Alan Dulles and his behavior vis-a-vis the assassination at considerable length in the description for the record program number 883. We will have some information from a book about the Dulles brothers called The Brothers by Stephen Kinzer that goes into the role of Sullivan and Cromwell in putting together U.S. Steel. Again, when we examine JFK going on, making a public address, identifying U.S. Steel and the steel industry as basically enemies of the American people, when we see RFK ordering the FBI into the offices of the top executives of one of this country's major corporate entities, and subpoenaing their records, checking out their expense accounts and so forth, I think we can see just how far we have come in the decades since that took place. This, again, was 1962, more than 50 years ago, and a little more than a year, roughly a year and a half, before JFK was killed. And again, note the ominous unsigned editorial in Henry Luce's Fortune magazine called The Ides of April, and basically questioning whether JFK was in effect a Soviet-style commissar. And it saw correctly, in the opinion of James Douglas, that the real mission of Roger Blau was to sort of act as a business statesman. In effect, JFK was being tested as to whether he would do the bidding of big business, or whether basically big business was going to have to play second fiddle, so to speak, to JFK. JFK attempted to coerce big business, in this case Big Steel, in the direction of the public interest, and he paid the price. This concludes For the Record program number 883. The times, they have changed. JFK and the Steel Crisis of 1962. My name's Dave Ember. This has been recorded on December 31st of the year 2015. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.